with those independent expenditures, the candidate should be able to have a relationship with the non-political side of that organization. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Fisher.
Good morning, everybody. If we have you have coordinated expenditures in front of you, I'll just kind of walk through. We tried to put bubbles on everywhere there was a change, but just walk through it and see if you have any questions and kind of explain the proposed new draft and how we think it fits into the draft you were provided. The first bubble itself on the subpart 3 for coordinated isn't actually a change. We've just had a little, I think, confusion over what the string of words there really is, and that's just directly citing the statutory definition from approved expenditures. The bubble has an alternative for proposed language in case that, you know, that was confusing, but that cites the statute itself, and I think the staff believes it's useful to have the language in the rule itself so that you don't have to flip back and forth in the statute book to find the language that you're looking for. The first actual change is in subpart 4, and that was simply changing person to individual. That's because in Chapter 10A, person is defined as basically anything. It includes an association. So using that statutory definition, it became kind of redundant and more confusing if you incorporate that in there. We therefore just made it individual to make clear that we're talking about, you know, single people for 4A. Second change is in subpart 6B, and that basically just teases out that the services for anything legal that's provided shouldn't involve campaign strategy. I don't think it's really a substantive change for how we discussed it at the last meeting. It's just clarifying that, you know, if the legal services that are provided to a candidate involve some form of campaign strategy, that would fit under the definition of being a consultant for the purposes of the coordinated expenditure prohibition on sharing consultants without a firewall. Flipping to page 2 is where we're going to get into the kind of new change that you'll have on a handout somewhere in your packet. We first changed this provision to say fundraising instead of fundraise, just to keep the terminology consistent with the sub-item 1 immediately below that says fundraising includes. A1 with the three parts of A, B, and C is where we have the proposed change in your handout, which is this document, obviously. And we had been grappling with, I think, Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life and the recent question from the Realtors Association, how to deal with fundraising and dues for things that aren't for a political purpose. Our initial packet that actually led to item I on the fourth page of the coordinated expenditure rules, if you flip one page over, which was trying to say that if you appear at a meeting or a function where your corporation is raising general treasury money, that's not a coordinated, it doesn't make a coordinated expenditure if that, you know, corporation later makes an expenditure on your behalf. I think our new impression is that this modification that we're proposing in the handout kind of solves both of the problems. You'd be able to delete that that subpart 8i, and then also by amending this language into the rule. And so basically it states that fundraising includes raising non-general treasury money for a group. And general treasury money is defined there in that handout, and it basically means, you know, dues and membership fees, money for the association's general purpose, anything that's not for political purposes, as we think of it. So donations to a principal campaign committee or a political committee or political party unit would meet that definition. So I guess if you have thoughts on the handout, I think we'd love to hear it. We think that it makes it a little cleaner also because there was some tension in terms of, you know, what the purpose of the meeting is when you look at the fundraising. The fundraising rule versus the new proposed I. We thought that got a little confusing, and hopefully this resolves some of those concerns.
Let me hold on there and just
see.
Yeah, I mean, we've been very informal. We don't, you don't have to get up or anything like that. Feel free to comment from your chair. We do have a mic. We give you fair warning because we found at the last meeting was sometimes better, or it was helpful to us to go back and hear what was exactly being said. Our notes weren't always consistent on the concerns, but if you just could give us some idea of what you think about that approach.
Hi, Christine Berger with the Minnesota Realtors. Thanks for the opportunity to comment and Thanks for reading my comments and turning around a solution so fast. I believe this addresses the problem. The situation was the National Association of Realtors. When we collect dues from the realtors, they pay all at once, their local association, their state association, and their national association dues at once. And membership gives them things like access to the transactional forms. So buying and selling real estate, all those forms you have to sign, we create those, not the financing ones, but the transactional ones. And so they need to have access to those, and multiple listing service access and so forth. So that was our concern, that they should be able to, because this is a mandatory thing of their career, they need to have this access, that it's treated differently than, say, a PAC investment, which is a voluntary contribution. So that was kind of the line for us. I believe this solution takes care of that concern. Thank you.
There's no other comments. The next change then was just a sort of de minimis exception to the reproduction dissemination part of the coordinated expenditure provisions. Basically states that if the reproduction costs $20 or less, then we were thinking of somebody forwarding on an email that they got for a candidate, something that really doesn't have any real value to it, that would be an exception to the expenditure being coordinated with the candidate. That kind of matches the $20 threshold on in-kind contributions, where it has to be, in-kind contributions, where it has to be reported, and there's no record keeping requirements for an in-kind contribution of $20 or less if you receive it. At the bottom of the page there on item D, it's just basically condensing everything that came in the last string of text down to coordinated, which is defined at the very start of the rule. We thought that it just read a lot cleaner instead of repeating all that language back, just to say coordinated once and kind of stick with that terminology. On page 3, in item E, this was another one where we just thought it read much more clearly to move the is into the two sub items, because it was a little confusing having the second one start with established, just kind of when you read it through. Subpart 8B was split into B and C. It basically says exactly the same thing, it just split it out into two exceptions instead of having an or with a long string after it. Thought that this makes the photo exception more clear, which I think was one of the areas where we thought was a little gray at the last meeting. And then finally on page 4 is the non-coordinated expenditure subpart I. And again, if people believe that the proposed modification of subpart 7A solved the problems, I think that this would be deleted in the next draft. That was all the changes for the coordinated expenditure.
Are there any more comments on that? Yes.
Hi, Christine again from the Realtors. I just want to thank you. Also, in the one of the last round additions, you added the subpart 8H, and that was great, because we hold usually after the session ends in June, sometimes we hold just legislative updates for our PAC investors as a recognition event, and so there's no fundraising going on. It's merely, they've already invested, it's merely a thank you for investing, and here's a delightful update from the caucus leaders and or their representatives. And so I think if you were to add any dates, like you can do it from here but not here, or within any time frames, it creates a problem, because if you do it, if you've got the primary, if it's in August and then 4 months before that, it's April, and so that's during the session, and they can't give an update then. And if the primary is in June, then it's even February. So some of the dates suggested in other submissions might be they would be problematic, but these are truly exclusively just recognition events for PAC investors. So thanks for adding that subdivision.
I think the comment that's being perhaps driving your comment was the one submitted in writing by George Beck. I think you have a copy of his letter. Related to 8H, the item has the potential to be a loophole to the prohibition against a candidate raising funds for the independent committee. It's a fine, invisible line between the candidate appearing to speak and the candidate promoting his or her election. This should either be deleted at a minimum or the following language added here in 20 days for the primary or general election for the office that the candidate is seeking. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's, perhaps we can strengthen a little bit in 8H to clarify that this is not when a candidate is appearing for support or fundraising, but especially with the possibility, I think, perhaps high probability that the primary is going to be in June, it would make it very difficult to do that prior to the primary.
Thank you very much.
So, I'm sorry.
No. Doug, did you have a question?
Well, no, discussion's open, I have an issue. Going back to Mr. Beck's comments, he's not here today, and he's been religious in his attendance in the past. He makes one other recommendation I would just like to get reaction to, if there is any, on the definition of agent. He suggests that we have a look back to include not just the current election segment, but he's promoting the Model Act, which goes back 4 years. But would there be objection to having language inserted that said the instant or previous election cycle to sort of deal with that issue? And I'll just let you think about that. His other comments, I think he wants us to follow a model instead of our own statute in certain language, where I might disagree with him. But that one I thought was something that was worth a discussion of. And you need not comment today, but as a member of the board, I found that to be at least something worth looking at.
Good morning, I'm John Rouleau. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Jobs Coalition and then the Minnesota Jobs Coalition Legislative Fund. With regard to that, my understanding of Mr. Beck's comments and his interpretation there was that you would know the candidate. Knowing a candidate does not make you an agent. An agent is someone who has the ability to influence what that candidate is going to do, who has explicit knowledge of what those plans are. That is something that within that one election segment, frankly, that might be too long. What you're looking at is trying to, what I think the board is looking at here is trying to make sure that you don't have a candidate having a staff member who then moves to the outside once they know what the plans are. That's where that coordination would come. And what makes you an agent is having that knowledge, not knowing a candidate. So when you try to look back 4 years, you're asking a lot of people who, frankly, there are not a lot of political campaigns that happen in Minnesota. There are not a lot of outside groups that happen in Minnesota. You're asking people to predict the future 4 years in advance and limit their potential job opportunities based on where they decided to work in a non-election year. It's very vague, and I think the idea that there's somehow a transfer of explicit knowledge about what would create a coordinated expenditure 3 or 4 years away from an election is really just unreasonable and not something that you would ever see happen, especially with how quickly things move in campaigns, how quickly things change. To come up with a plan 4 years out is really not practical. So that would be my comment on that. But if you have questions.
What is your reaction to one that would go back to the previous cycle, election 7?
Well, again, I think, you know, campaigns change, right? And if we're trying to prevent somebody from transferring explicit knowledge, which would defeat the independence of an expenditure, yeah, I think that that's really the test here, right? It's not, have I worked for somebody in any capacity over the last 4 years? It's what is the knowledge explicitly that defeats the independence of an expenditure? And the fact that you may have worked for somebody on a prior campaign that's not the same campaign. We know that political environments change. We are very aware that the elections in 2018 will be very different from the elections in 2016. If you had asked people in 2015 what their plans were for the elections in 2016, nobody would have been correct. So the idea that there is somehow this knowledge that is retained and transferred about explicit plans that would defeat the independence of an expenditure just isn't realistic.
When your organization, the political side, starts to develop a budget for its independent expenditures, is that typically within, and I realize you're just one independent expenditure, but is that typically within 6 months of the expenditures, or do you start developing a budget 2 years out or a year out?
We typically try to come up with an expenditure in the spring before the election, as far as what would be the ideal. But then, that changes based on funds that are coming in, what the landscape of the election looks like. This year, we obviously had a lot of changes that happened late as we figured out who the candidates were going to be. The filing deadline, I think, is when we really kind of understand what things are going to look like, and then that changes even after the primary. As we make decisions based on who the candidates are who are facing each other, whether or not that's a competitive race, what the districts look like, and then up until the election, things are fluid. While we might have a general idea 6 months out, 9 months out, of what we would like to do, that remains very fluid up until post-primary.
Let me just follow up. First of all, thank you for coming, and thank you for obviously taking the time to look at the comments that were being submitted. That's great. Are there other areas? I think this is your first time attending a rulemaking, correct?
I was at the one 2 times ago.
The first one.
Yes.
Are there any other specific concerns that your organization has about what's being proposed here?
At this point, not that I have had a chance to look at it with enough detail to provide you with an educated response. Thanks.
Lucas Nessie with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And just going back to Mr. Rulo's comments regarding the 2 year versus 4 year, whatever, if you're looking for guidance, if anything, I'd say that I would agree with everything he said, that that's an extremely long time. And if you're looking for guidance, I believe federal law has a 45 day cool down period. So just wanted to make sure the board was aware of that.
There's no script.
Sorry, I want to go to the area, some of the comments on the non-independent expenditure issue, and specifically the mutual fund. One of the rule changes that's being proposed here is to eliminate mutual funds from you're having to disclose those in your economic interest statements. And I'm just curious, we haven't really had any discussion with any persons outside of board members during public meetings about that issue. And does anyone have a reaction to that or to the area of the statements of economic interest generally? Is that an issue that anybody here cares about at all? Now, you're technically, you know, the statements of economic interest deal with the disclosure requirements of public officials. So you're representing people other than public officials, and I understand that here. But any thoughts, comments? Nothing, that's fine.
Jody, were you going to, could you walk through then the next set of, this is the non-expenditure provisions disclaimer?
Yeah, this one has a date, March 8th, and then it says draft disclaimer and other non-expenditure provisions. So this is kind of the second group of rules that we're looking at. The first one just incorporates the statutory definition of campaign material because we need that for the section on disclaimers. The second part is the one that Mr. Moylan was just talking about. That was the change that we discussed at the last meeting to make it clear that public officials don't have to disclose their holdings or their shares in a mutual fund just because that disclosure seemed to be not very helpful to the public. 4503-0500, that's another change that was discussed at the last meeting. This just clarifies that when you get a committee gets an electronic contribution, for deposit purposes in item D, it's the date that you have access to the funds, but in item C, before it said all other purposes besides deposit, well, this has been changed a little bit to actually list those purposes, so that people will know what that date applies to. The subpart 10 on the bottom of page 1 is a new provision. This amendment just clarifies that contribution processors don't have to register or report under 10A just because of their business activities of processing and delivering those contributions. That codifies an advisory opinion. At the top of page 2, 4503-1400, subpart 3A, this also codifies an advisory opinion 412. Right now, under the statute, if you're a candidate who signs a public subsidy agreement, one of the things that you agree to is that your committee will not make independent expenditures. So someone asked the board, well, you know, I know my committee can't make independent expenditures. Can I donate committee funds to an independent expenditure committee, which by definition can only make independent expenditures? And the advisory opinion said that no, you couldn't use your committee funds that way because that is really just circumventing that statutory provision saying that you agreed that you wouldn't spend your campaign money on independent expenditures. So subpart 3A just codifies that advisory opinion into the rule. Subpart 10 addresses a situation that the board experienced this last fall. There's a new provision in 204E that covers what happens when there's a vacancy and nomination that occurs shortly before the general election. And what 204B provides is that they call a special election that's held in February. The problem, though, is that that special election doesn't have a filing period, and all the deadlines for the public subsidy program for a special election payment are tied to the filing period. So this subpart just explains that when you have an election with no filing period, these are the dates that apply to public subsidy program. I think what I'm going to do now is I'm going to skip the disclaimer part just quickly to go to the last provision on page 4. This is another one that was in the earlier announcements. 2 years ago, the board adopted rules that apply to investigations. And the rules were set up to have staff reviews and investigations. And the way that they worked out is that every staff review has to go to the board. And when a staff review goes to the board, it has to go with a submission from the executive director that can be quite long, explaining what happened and why it could be resolved by an agreement. The process is set up to expect the respondent to object to that submission, so it expects the respondent to be submitting something and then the board to be making a rather major decision on the submission. What we found in practice, though, is that most of the staff reviews either are resolved because there's no violation whatsoever, or the other side agrees that, yeah, there was a violation and we want to get this over with as quickly as possible and move on. Well, the way the system is set up now, that doesn't work because we have to go through this long submission process. So what the provisions from page 4 through the end of the document do is just set up a quicker way to resolve a staff review. If there's no violation, the executive director can just close the matter and it's done. If there is a violation but there's no need for a formal investigation because the respondent agrees that there was a violation and they agree to the outcome, then it can just go to the board with an order or some kind of writing that explains how the matter is going to be resolved. So it should really simplify and speed up the process for a lot of our staff review investigations. Now I'm going to turn back to the disclaimers because I think that's the one where most people are going to have more interest. The way the statutes are set up now is there's a disclaimer for campaign material in 211B04 that's very specific. It says you need to have this language when you have campaign material. In 10A17, there's kind of a more general description of the language that you need on an independent expenditure. There's no specific language there. And then there's nowhere in the statute that explains how the independent expenditure language is supposed to fit with the 211B campaign material language. So we get a lot of questions from people who are doing independent expenditures or who are doing campaign material that's shared with more than one spender, I don't want to use spender, but more than one group that's producing it, because it's not really clear what disclaimer they should be using. So subparts 1, 2, and 3 explain what language would satisfy the requirements in both the independent expenditure disclaimer provision and the campaign material disclaimer provision for an independent expenditure. So it says if you use that language, you would satisfy both statutes. Subpart 1 is if the independent expenditure is in opposition to a candidate. Subpart 2 is in support of. And then subpart 3 just codifies the statutory requirement that you can omit the words paid for if it didn't have any cost. Subpart 4 then covers the situation where you're supporting one candidate and opposing another. On page 3, subpart 5 is where your independent expenditure supports more than one candidate or opposes more than one candidate. Subpart 6 and 7 outline what happens when you have more than one participant, either in an independent expenditure or just in regular campaign material. Subpart 8 addresses another question that we get a lot from candidate committees. There's a provision that says that if you do a communication to your constituents during the 60 days after the legislature adjourns, you can report that as half a campaign expenditure and half a non-campaign disbursement. If it's more than 60 days after the legislature adjourns, then it's totally a campaign expenditure. So we've gotten a lot of questions about, since it's a half campaign expenditure, what kind of disclaimer does that communication need? So subpart 8 would establish that you just use the campaign material disclaimer anytime when part of the communication has to be reported as a campaign expenditure. Subpart 9 is the area where we're really hoping to get some input from people who actually do independent expenditure communications or campaign material communications. One of the statutes says that the disclaimer has to be in conspicuous type, and then the campaign material says it has to be prominently displayed. So we do get some questions about what that means, and we put some provisions in that attempt to maybe codify a type, a point type size requirement, but we're not really sure if that's practical. We don't really know, you know, what size communications different groups are doing. So, you know, any input on that language would be especially appreciated. At the top of page 4, sub-item D there is what size the disclaimer would have to be on a website or a social media page. That one's not really tied to a type size. It's just more pointing out that it should be the same as the other tape or the other type sizes that are used in the communication. Item B talks about an outline box. Again, you know, we're not sure how that would work in practice, if that's possible in an email communication or in other kinds of communication. So feedback there would be really appreciated. And then finally, subpart 10 there on the top of page 4 talks about the disclaimer requirements for websites and social media pages. Just clarifying that if you have the disclaimer once on the home page, then that would satisfy it for the site. So those are the provisions in that section. Does anybody have any comments on those? Did either of you have any comments?
Mm-hmm. No.
Took care of my issue.
Okay.
Well, as I kind of stated in other meetings, I think part of the statement of economic interest issue is going to be a legislative issue mm-hmm. in the future that we're going to have to look at totally. But if, for example, if we're going to take out mutual funds, which there's a lot of common sense to that in my mind. Shouldn't we be taking out exchange-traded funds, ETFs? Isn't that the same sort of animal? Should there be something dealing with a percentage of interest? So I don't think people should have to disclose their mutual fund holdings or ETF holdings as long as those holdings are, say, less than 2% of the value of the fund as a whole. Should we be going in that direction? So I have no problem with this change, but I think that a broader look at the area of statement of economic interests with the legislature is going to become important in the future as we're dealing with, this sounds dramatic, somewhat of a crisis in confidence by the public in our processes. So there are areas where I believe we can strengthen our disclosure requirements and areas where we can eliminate certain disclosure requirements, because over the past 40 years, things have changed since the statute came into play. So I'll mention that, even though that doesn't directly involve this group, I feel like as a member of the board, people should have a right to know my interest in the area.
I think I'll go back to maybe provide my perspective as from an administrative standpoint, amplifying what Jody said on disclaimers. It may seem like we're spending a lot of time here on disclaimers. In part, this reflects the number of phone calls and emails we get during the election asking us what the heck does the disclaimer need to look like. So there's a lot of and, you know, frankly, staff has tried to provide an answer that seemed common sense, but which was probably not strictly based on a reasonable interpretation of how we thought the two disclaimer requirements could work together. We definitely will feel more confident in providing that information, changing it into training material and providing it in other formats once we have administrative rules in place. But we are running into this issue of what's a reasonable way of doing this with font size. I don't really expecting them to have an immediate input, but we're a little stuck. I mean, it seems silly to have, you know, on the bottom of page 3, if you say, well, it's 8.5 by 11, that means the disclaimer has to be at least, let's pretend, 10-point type. And then somebody reduce, you know, distributes something with a 9-point type, is that the basis of a complaint to the board? From my perspective, that would be sort of a frivolous complaint. So I prefer to find some other way of doing this than relying on a point type requirement. But we have kind of run out of imagination in this area. So if somebody has some other way of looking at that issue, we really appreciate trying to find it. And we have looked at some other states to see what they've done. And I think typically they do rely on a particular font size or type. So. But anyway, that's an area of concern. If something occurs to you as you're going along, we'd love to hear. There isn't any other comments on that one. The rest of this might actually go fairly quickly. I did want to update you. There is another rulemaking docket, as you will recall, the non-controversial rule docket, which we think is pretty much in place. It's available on the website. I don't think we brought that, Joe, did we?
Yeah, there's that was the technical amendments, and there's copies over there if you don't have one.
But we think that's pretty much where we're going to be on those, but they're modifying existing rules as opposed to creating new rules. In both cases, there is a bill in the legislature, in both cases, I mean both the House and the Senate, there's legislation that has moving to take the non-controversial rules and codify them. Senator Kiffmeyer has sent file 839, which was introduced and is now passed out of the Senate Elections, Operations, and Finance Committee to the General Finance Committee. And then there's also, just introduced yesterday, was House File 2419, which is the companion bill. Representative O'Driscoll for his House Committee on State Government Operations. They vary somewhat. The Senate File 839 also has language that limits the board's authority to make administrative rules going forward. House File 2419 does not have that language. So there is differences, but in both cases, the non-controversial rules are being moved forward by that legislation. I think our response to that is that, well, we might as well wait and see what happens. If it's going to be codified, then there's no reason for us to move forward to a notice of intent to adopt those rules. There'll be lots of time to do so if the legislature decides not to enact either of those bills. So for the time being, basically those are on standby. The other topic that we wanted to go through here is probably, and I don't know everyone in the audience, but it's probably more an issue for candidates, and that's looking at the next major set of rules on non-campaign disbursements. What we do have, we did provide, is this document, which was listing the advisory opinions and findings over the years in which the board has addressed various types of non-campaign disbursements that a candidate can make from their campaign committee. Most of them are, I think, fairly straightforward, and I don't know that there's really a lot of issue that we'll be dealing with administrative rule, but there are two areas in particular which stand out. One is the cost of serving in office that you can find on page 7. Okay, with some of the problems that have come up. And then also constituent services on page 8. I think what the board is going to be struggling with is this conflict. On one hand, I believe that that the money raised by principal campaign committees is being donated by people who are trying to help that candidate be elected. They also receive public subsidy money in most cases that has to be used for expenditures to help that candidate be elected. All of these expenditures, the non-campaign disbursements, are unrelated to the cost of being elected. It's the cost of being a legislator. And how exactly is that balanced between how the money was collected and the purpose it was donated for versus the idea that the candidate can now, as a member of the legislature, use that to support their being in the legislature, either in paying down the cost of them attending session, through mileage, through meals, what they can do for constituents that doesn't start to raise the question of if the money is being used as appropriate in Chapter 10A. It's been a conflict, it's been a point of tension, and I think it's also going to be a point of tension as we try to develop these rules, make sure the legislature is aware of where we're going, because we continue to find examples where they believe something was appropriate and the board frankly did not. Because sometimes administrative rule, or excuse me, advisory opinions on a particular topic have everyone's attention, but then over the years, the advisory opinion starts to get buried, people forget about it, and then when they find that they disclose something on their report and the board has an issue with that, then we're back to, again, that sort of conflict. So we're trying to move all of these advisory opinions that you find in this document and address at least the great majority of them through administrative rule. This is going to be the last, I think, is this correct, Jody, the last significant set of rules that's going to come out of this effort. We have some work done. We haven't had a chance to work with our two board members to see what they're thinking on this area, but as soon as we have that, we'll put that onto our website so you can start seeing where we're going. I think from the staff's perspective, this needs to be fairly tight, and by that I mean, well, I'll give you an example. Cell phones has been an area of it's been problematic. Certainly it's acknowledged that a member of the legislature is going to have a legitimate need to have a cell phone where constituents can call them, where their staff can reach them. And I don't think the board has ever had a problem with a cell phone being paid for by the committee for the legislator to use as an on-campaign disbursement. The problem is then, should it always be a single phone plan, or can they take some portion of a family plan and pay for that with committee funds? At least initially, it seems to me that the best way to resolve that problem is to say you can't be paying part of a family plan with your committee's funds. It just causes too many calculations that a volunteer treasurer has to make, that raises issues about were they considering all the factors in terms of data use by other members of the plan. It's just too messy. And so, for example, one of the rules that's probably going to be drafted is that if you're going to have a phone paid for by your committee, then only the legislator can be on that plan. It can't be a family plan. That's sort of the direction we're going. I suspect there'll be a lot of feedback on that. But we would certainly like to hear from everybody on those issues as we start to deal with those rules. Is there any last thoughts?
I think that's it.
We are going to have another meeting, but I'm afraid we don't have a date to announce now. We're going to need to coordinate here with our board members to figure out when that works. But we'll be looking, three or four weeks out of the summer.
Yeah, I think it definitely would be the second, no earlier than the second week in April, and probably maybe a week later after that.
Maybe you could just highlight that, assuming that we bring this to ground, we get language that works for us, the board approves it, at some point after another public meeting,
right.
What would be the next step?
The next step then would be to start the things that you need to do to publish the notice of intent to adopt. So you need to draft a SONAR and get the revisor's approval and the governor's approval and those things, and then we would publish the notice of intent to adopt probably sometime in the summer.
So even though there would be one more meeting publicly and probably at least two board meetings that would be public where people could comment, they could also comment on publication of the rules themselves.
Yeah, there's a lot of time.
We got a lot more opportunity for you to all come to meetings if you wish, or to certainly submit written comments is my point.
Yeah, and yeah, definitely. Anytime. I mean, if you have a comment, it's so much easier to address a comment early in the process. If you make a comment during the formal 30-day comment period, that's great. But at that point, every change we make has to go through the revisor's office, which takes time. I mean, if you make a comment now, the change only has to go through us, and we can turn that around pretty quickly. So we have a lot more flexibility to address comments that are made before that notice of intent to adopt is published. So if you have a comment, just send one of us an email. That would be great, and then we can start working on it early.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.